call to order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Thursday again already, March 13th, 2003. We had originally scheduled a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2650A, but we're not going to go into that work session or hearing this morning. The bill will be having a amendment drafted for it that will deal with an unrelated issue, except that it relates to the relating clause very well. And we'll see that bill back in here at the beginning of next week with the technical amendment ready to go. And we will be doing a public hearing on 5052, continuing that and hopefully finishing it up today. But Mr. Bender has some announcements for us before we have that hearing called to order.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I distributed a buff-colored sheet to you this morning, which is the tentative agenda or the planned agenda for the subcommittee next week. Basically, the plan is to take the first 3 days of next week for the budget of the Oregon Health and Science University. That should take 3 days. And on the third day, part of that day would be set aside for public testimony. On Thursday of next week, you will have scheduled the Oregon University System's capital construction budget. There's a separate bill for capital construction for OUS and for their operations. This is the only agency where the state finances capital construction. So there will be that bill on Thursday. And as the chair just mentioned to you this morning, at some point we'll be rescheduling in House Bill 2650 in addition to what you see here. We don't know yet exactly which day that will be.
Thank you. Anyone have questions or comments on the schedule? Good. I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 5052, which is the budget of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And Mr. Sweetser, please proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we are going to shortly start our discussion about the Oregon Opportunity Grant. But before I do that, I wanted to just share with you some information that we prepared in response to some questions that come up before this committee. There are three pieces of paper that I put on top of your notebooks. The first one looks like this, and it is some additional information in regards to performance measures. We had some questions about what are the actual numbers, and I'll just go through those briefly. The first one is on measure 575-2, some additional information about the Oregon Opportunity Grants relative to the national average of grant dollars per FTE. The second measure was wanting some additional information about the number and dollar amounts of scholarships, 575-5. You'd ask for some additional information on the numbers and dollar amounts of what we call those lender requests for assistance or default version activities that we engage with borrowers. And then the last is some dollars in regards to our defaulted student loan portfolio. And the percentage that is on that chart is the percentage of the portfolio that we collect at the end of the year, throughout the year. The next page is a updated version of a sample financial aid package, and we will look at this when we get into talking about the budget note report. But there have been some questions and discussion surrounding cost of education and how financial aid plays out in helping a student finance an education. And in the budget note report, at the time that we prepared this, 2000-2001, the average cost of attendance was about $12,000, $11,921. And after taking into account a full opportunity grant, a full Pell student loan work study, and a student loan, the financial aid fell about $2,900 short of meeting a student's ability to pay for college. So the analogy I use is you go to the store to buy a gallon of milk, it costs $3, and you have $2.50 in your pocket. The grocery store is not going to sell you a gallon of milk. They're not going to give you a gallon of milk for $2.50. They want $3. So what we've seen is that the cost of attendance has risen. The financial aid for Pell Grant has risen has increased of about $300. The opportunity grant has gone down a couple hundred dollars, and the net effect is the unmet need has increased by about $1,000. The second set of documents are a couple of pieces that we prepared in response to the first question is what the state gains by continuing to have a single agency administer the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. And I'm not going to go through those, but I would just leave those with you to read and reflect on, and I'm more than happy to have a continuing conversation with you in regards to this. The second piece is some information about programs that we currently administer that we receive no administrative funds for. And there are, I haven't counted them, but there's about 10 or 12 that are listed there. And some of those are no longer active programs, but there is still workload associated with those. And then the last piece is why should the Oregon Student Assistance Commission be in the student loan guarantee business? And again, I'll leave that information with you and be happy to engage you in an additional further conversation. And then the last piece of paper is a copy out of our budget note report. It's on page 39, and it lays out what amount of aid could make a difference. And that correlates to that that one slide that talks about the cost of education and how much aid is available and what students are missing or what they have to make up or in order to be able to go to college. I don't think I explained that very well, but we can cover that additionally when we get into the budget note report.
Questions or comments on these three pieces of information?
Madam Chair, I have a question. I've always been intrigued by the way we determine what we pay each student as far as the Oregon Opportunity Grant is concerned. It's based partially, I believe, on the cost of going to that particular institution. So if it's cheaper to go to U of O or Oregon State or Willamette, you get less of a grant, and if you go to an institution that costs more as far as tuition is concerned, you get a bigger grant to a certain degree. And that's my understanding of it, and correct me if I'm wrong. I always felt that that we should determine what we can afford to give out as a voucher, and then the student can take that to whatever institution they want to go to and get the best value for the dollar, because I think students can make that decision. And they may find that going to a private school where they don't have quite as much match money from this program will still work for them. The fact is, I've got a couple of kids that are interns with me that come from middle and low-income families in Southern Oregon who are going to Willamette because of this grant and what the schools put together. It's actually cheaper for them to go to Willamette than it was for them to go to U of O. They applied to both schools. Having said that, you know, if we were to set the voucher at a flat fee, we could probably put more kids into schools. We'd have a larger number that would get the money and potentially get more bang for our buck. But I'd like to hear your comment on that, because that's still something that troubles me, that by picking a certain school, you get more on your opportunity grant than by picking another school. It has a tendency to drive kids to, you know, as a policy, it might drive kids to more expensive schools and limits the number of kids to get it. I'd rather see more kids, or I shouldn't say kids, I suppose. My age, everybody's a kid now. More students.
They're always kids.
They're always kids. But more students, you might have a larger number of students get the voucher than are getting it now. It wouldn't be a huge number, but it could be 400 or 500. So a comment, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Gates, and members of the committee, in when you look at that in its just as a statement, it seems to make sense, but we've gone in and taken a look at what if you set it at a certain amount for all students and allowed students to choose their institution based upon that. And if you set the grant amount at about what an Oregon University System student receives, which is about $1,400, what ends up happening is that there are very few independent college students that are participating in the Oregon Opportunity Grant. There's about 1,100, 1,200. but there are tens of thousands, 10,000 community college students and Oregon University student system students. So what you end up doing is increasing the amount of aid that would go to a community college student, and you would actually serve fewer state system. You're shifting a lot of the resources out of the state system schools who have higher costs. And you will be able to serve a few more students, but unless you put additional funds in to make this grant serve the existing population, we're not really gaining a lot. It requires a significant sum of additional dollars in order to serve students. If you wanted to serve everyone who, with a voucher, if you wanted to make a promise to every student, if you graduate from college or you want to return to school, you're 35, and here's X number of dollars, it's a big chunk of change. It's much more than we currently receive in support of this program. And I'd be happy to get that, model that information. We have it. I don't have it right here. But if you're only talking about existing dollars and establishing a grant that is somewhere between a private college and a community college grant, you can serve a few more students. But the reality is that we're leaving a lot of students outside the room when it comes to handing out an opportunity grant to a low-income Oregonian.
Follow up, Representative Bates?
Yes. I just don't follow the logic of that. I mean, you admit that you're leaving people out of the room. It would seem logical to me to bring at least a few more into the room at a lower level than to leave them out entirely. But we fight the same battles in the Oregon Health Plan.
Mm-hmm.
And you draw your line somewhere. But it just seems to me inappropriate that kids that decide to go to a higher education facility that has higher tuition draw more from this program, a publicly funded program, than those who would like to go somewhere else. And spreading what few dollars we have as far as we can, as far as number of students, would seem to me to be the greatest use of this money, and giving as great an opportunity for as many students as possible to go to higher education is the real goal of the program. And I'm concerned that when you make those kind of policy decisions to leave somebody out of the room, to use your own phrase, because there's not enough money, and I understand that, mm-hmm. that you're contracting the number of students have an opportunity to go. It's just a policy decision. And probably in reality doesn't make a huge difference. But to those 400 or 500 students who would pick up a grant who have nothing now, it might make a difference. And that's my point.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, members of the committee, I understand where you are coming from, because that is where our commission comes from. And this is an issue that we grapple with all the time. And sometimes the decisions that the commission makes aren't the decisions that they really want to make. But the economics of the state's budget situation lead us to decisions that aren't in the direction that we want to go. And the example that we're going to be looking at is we reduced our income eligibility criteria to exclude more people out of the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, because if we had not, we would be serving less than half of the students who qualified for the Opportunity Grant. So as it stands right now, we're hoping to be able to serve about 55%. So the commission is always looking at striking a balance between providing a meaningful benefit for a student in Oregon to gain an education, and there are students who choose to go to a community college because they want to be close to home. They like the environment that a community college has. There's some who want a four-year experience, that some in a public, some in a private. There are some family values that drive students to make decisions. So it is a huge calculation in trying to strike a balance that makes sense to provide a meaningful benefit to allow a student to gain an education in Oregon. Yeah. I welcome this conversation.
Madam Chair? Representative sure. March has a question. Representative Smith has a question. And thank you.
Thank you. And I was thinking of it in, along Dr. Bates's lines, but maybe saying instead of flat amount across, because certainly community college is are at a different rate, but something like 15% of up to whatever, like a state university rate. So it's 15%, say, at the community college. That would bring the community college folks up a little. And it would bring the state universities up a little, and then it would level out. So everybody else, it would be at the 15%. And I know that would probably be a burden on some of the independent colleges in that we would have a problem of not being able to fund as many students going, you know, or going to the independent ones at the, or as deeply. They'd be less than 11% then, probably. So that was just my thoughts.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don't you, when determining student costs, you apply the same living expenses to every student regardless of where they attend and whether they live at home or on campus?
We use the school's cost of education factors. So.
Okay. Well, wouldn't a student who lived at home have a much smaller cost of education than a student who lived on campus?
Yes, they would.
Well, then... But they get the same amount of money.
In the Opportunity Grant program?
In any of it. Especially the Opportunity Grant.
I think so.
So, Representative Smith, what you're after is if there is a different
well, I think they,
that's applied to students that are living at home rather
than... Yeah, you compare your cost of a student living on campus. Why don't we have like a commuter cost of an independent of a dependent student, pardon me, who's still living at home with their parents... You know, I think that can, obviously their costs are going to be much less if they're not having to pay their own rent and food, unlike a student who is 30 years old living on their own. I think there are many students who are, maybe the trend is for community colleges living at home with mom and dad so they can save money, but the awards are the same. So what if we develop like a commuter cost, just like they have a living away from home cost, because I believe it's calculated on living off campus, if I'm not mistaken. And so if that was the case, the student who lived at home would actually get less money because the theory is they don't need it, and therefore more money will go into the pot to fund more students with the same amount of money.
Correct me if I'm not if I'm off base here. But the form that the students have to fill out from the federal government that kind of sets the eligibility level, isn't part of that a discussion of the resources that are available to the student?
The family income? Yes, the free application for federal student aid determines the expected family contribution based upon the income and assets of the family.
Based on income and assets. Okay. So,
and they factor in
but if a student applies at Clackamas Community College and lives within 5 miles of Clackamas and they're going to drive, okay, doesn't the college determine their student educational costs at X dollars? And do they differentiate it, for instance, at Clackamas? Based on their grants, does a student live at home and dependent on the parents and therefore doesn't need as much?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, and members of the committee, I don't know the answer to that, but I will find it out.
Well, I think it bears looking into.
When I was doing compliance reviews 10 years ago, community college did have commuter budgets, and I don't know whether they still have those or not. So we may be able to have an answer for you before this hearing is over.
If I might.
Please.
I'm Brian Clem. I'm the chair of the Student Assistance Commission. You've asked three questions in a row that I've asked many times, actually. So you're talking about policy. It's the same exact thinking we do. And there is an answer for that exact question, because when we went to do our That question is, can I remember it at this moment? I'm going to try. If not, I'll get it quickly, because I asked that exact same question. We were offered that as a way to save money when we did our most recent policy decision for next year. And some, I think it was in the independent colleges, sent a letter with that saying, can't you figure out some kind of commuter factor and reduce it by some $1,000 to, you know, I think $3,000 to account for that. And I asked our staff, and they gave me a really excellent reason why that wouldn't be a good idea. And the problem is the person who gave me the answer isn't here, which is Jim. But I can certainly get it for you, because I was quite curious about that, too. It made sense to me. If you could save a little money, why not offset the grant by that amount and shift it into something else? Unfortunately, I can't remember it now, because I've asked a lot of questions.
Probably not save a little money, but a whole lot of money, in that we could distribute more money to more students.
I thought that, too. There is some answer. I'll get it for you and see whether it makes sense. Maybe you don't buy it. It made sense to me, and I consider myself a fairly tough-minded arguer, but it made sense at that point.
Maybe we'll do some outside research on this issue.
Well, and I kind of suspect that if the person that knows this answer is watching this, or there was a cell phone that just left, that we will get this information in a really short time frame.
The other, I don't know if you want to revisit the Representative Bates' question, but if you want to talk about that now, I'd be happy to. Otherwise, we can talk about it later.
Please.
We struggle with that same issue, and without giving you, without giving you complex answers and trying to just talk cowboy talk here, we've done it exactly the way Representative March described. I think I maybe told you this last session. It's your colleagues who have had an issue with that, not the commission per se. We have our own beliefs about if you did a shift the way you described, a just pure flat grant, you end up just taking from the public 4 years and giving it to the community college. So you are, whether you intend to or not, shifting enrollment patterns in the state by where you allocate the dollars. If you did a flat grant model on the privates, basically, and lowered them down to the publics, you get into what we had before about 4 years ago. And so if your colleagues and you want to go back to that model, we'll implement it. But the bottom line is we had that. And then there were separate side programs that dealt just with private school students. And we agreed as a commission, okay, you're going to lose all your separate standalone programs, but we're going to fold you into our formula. And they didn't come out on the high end. They lost money by doing that. But they wanted to be, in my view, you know, not separate standalone programs, which were easy ducks for people to eyeball. And so the bottom line is, that's your call. And if you all, you know, want to implement that, and you've got your colleagues and your votes, we'll implement it. But, you know, we made a deal with groups to cancel their other programs, lose money, and fold them into our formula.
Follow up, Representative Bates?
Yes. Illuminating conversation. I appreciate it, okay? let me put it in a little different context, possibly, for people. I spent the last 20 or 25 years in a community of that has low income, a lot of bright kids that want to go on to higher education. Okay? The biggest single barrier for them, and it wasn't the only barrier, but the biggest single barrier for them was financial. And most of them chose to go to Rogue Community College because that's all they could afford, and Rogue Community College offered them an excellent start on their education for the first 2 years. It was, to use the phrase I commonly use, a lot more bang for their buck. They would love to go on to Willamette. They would love to go on to UVO. They would love to go on to any number of excellent schools we have in this state. But frankly, they and their families couldn't afford it. Kids stayed at home and lived with their families and not got the full college experience because they couldn't afford to go someplace where they had to put $14,000 out. They had to live at home and do the best they could and get the first 2 years behind them at the lowest possible cost. And they still had to work to do that. After that, many of them transferred on up. Most of them, unfortunately, I believe, I haven't got the statistics, but the ones I've seen couldn't go on any further and had to quit because they couldn't afford to go further. All I'm saying is I want the public money to go as far as we can to get as many kids as we can into higher education and get them that education. And I don't particularly care if it's at a community college or at a four-year college or at a private school. They all offer something wonderful to these kids. And I don't care which one it is. I want as many people having an opportunity to go and go into those schools as possible. And the biggest barrier facing kids in the state, as far as I'm concerned, and I can be swayed on this, is money. It's money. And I don't think anyone in this room is going to argue with me very long about that. So I want the most from this grant. This is not, I mean, we got 10,000 kids out here. We're talking picking up 500 more. All I'm saying is let's get the most money, the most bang for our buck here. If it's at the community college level the first 2 years, that's where it goes. If it's at the community, if it's above that or it's a private school with match money from private funds, that's great too. And I'm not taking shots at private institutions or U of O or Oregon State or Rogue Community. I don't care. I just want as many people as possible getting a higher education. And we got limited amount of finances here. Let's spread it as far as we can. Does that make sense?
That makes sense to me. You've just described my family. My brother went to SWOC in Coos Bay with a single parent and me waiting, Southwestern Oregon Community College. Then he went to OSU. Sorry about that. That's what we call it in Coos Bay. Then he went to OSU, and then as soon as I became eligible, we both qualified for a new grant so we could both go to the big town of Corvallis. So, and you know what? At the time, if someone had said, remember the kid next door? Yeah, he's going to Willamette, and he's got a $3,000 grant, and you have a $1,200 grant. Wouldn't you like to have his $1,100 to share between you and your brother? I would have said yes. And I'm not so sure that our commission, there aren't the votes on our commission to do that. But the bottom line for us is this legislature 4 years ago made that decision for us. There is a policy reason behind it, too, which is you will take people on a proportional basis to what school they want to go to and say, we can't match the cost of your school. We're going to have to artificially cap the cost. And, you know, it's a policy decision that says we need to go for hamburgers and not steak. I understand what you're trying to say. And, again, we implement directions from the legislature. That's not been the policy of the legislature over the years. And we're happy to implement what you do. There are reasons, you know, the cost shifting, but I think you understand those and are choosing to say that's okay with me. And, you know, we respect that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging me this morning.
Senator Gordon, you have been incredibly patient.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just wanted to establish for the record that I agree totally with everything that has been raised by Representative Bates. These are issues and concerns that have been longstanding for a number of us. And with that said, I think one of the overarching issues we have in the state is, you know, we say that we want a seamless educational system that's pre-K through higher education. If it's truly seamless, then we don't make these distinctions that fragment public over here, private over there. That's a part of the struggle that we have is we haven't really internalized the seamless thinking. With that said, this is just another observation. I believe it's still true that the majority of students wishing to get a wishing to become teachers choose private institutions. I think the majority of our teachers come out of private institutions, so that's a choice that they're making, and then you have to look at what's the equity in terms of the dollars that they receive after making that choice to go to a private institution. I hope you're tracking my thinking here. I'm just raising a question.
Comment?
I think that you do end up, by not even considering what it costs, making those enrollment choices. So if there's an effect like we get less teachers because that's where they generally choose to go, we're being blind to where what it really costs there. And we're, you know, I think, you know, I'm sure hopefully you'll hear from the independent colleges about, you know, there's a lot more reasons than I know. But there are subsidies, essentially, that the state puts into the state system that if you were going to calculate true cost would be a different number than what you would see in terms of what you see on paper now. So if you took all that stuff out and you figured out what truly is the true cost and maybe not the market cost, but the true cost of education, and then you fixed it according to that formula, you will get shifts. because you'll lower your grant sizes and people will see a larger hole in their financial aid package and you'll get shifts. And if the unintended consequence, and I don't know too much about the facts of where teachers choose to go. You know, I've just heard Western, and I know a lot that do go to independent schools. But you would get shifts, and you would probably want to know what the shifts were before you did it. If you had a critical shortage area, especially, and you were trying to not have it worsened by some action you made.
Well, and just briefly, Madam Chair, I agree with Representative Bates that, again, the overarching principle is one of choice. And equity of opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bender wishes to share some comments with us on the information that we just received in the handouts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had two very brief comments. On the handout, it looks like this. It says underlying statistics and talks about the performance measures. I just wanted to clarify for you that second performance measure, 575-3, refers to the private awards program. I believe that's correct.
Correct.
The number of students who are receiving opportunity grants is much higher. It's closer to 19,000 per year. So this is the separate donator-funded award program that this is referring to. The other comment I'd like to make on the materials that were just distributed are in the other set of materials, the one that on the top has the page that says what the state gains by continuing to have a single agency. But on the second page of that handout, there's a list of programs administered by OSAC with no administrative funding. And I did want to comment, and I've had this discussion with the agency as well, that LFO sort of takes a bit of exception to this type of representation, because the fact of the matter is that in the budgets that the state has been approving and that is being requested by the governor, there are funds for administration. And if you look at the chart there that's on the easel up there, you can see the administrative division general funds are about $227,000. Then the next line, grant administration, $404,000. These are funds that the state is providing to administer grant programs, including the opportunity grant and these programs here. And, you know, there may be a question of, well, maybe the agency doesn't think that's enough, but it's really not the case that we're only providing funding and they only can use it for one program and not for others. And I think that the agency is probably looking at a situation when these new programs came online, they weren't given additional administrative support at that time. But what we do each budget cycle is look at their budget, look at how much we're funding for their administration, and we don't look at it as saying, well, we're only funding administrative costs for one program and not the others. At least that's how we will represent.
Questions or comments for Mr. Bender? I think we can finally begin the
Madam Chair, if I might just briefly, not a rebuttal, but just comment on that. I agree with Steve. The funding streams don't come in uniquely identified to a program, but there are costs associated with administering these programs, and over time, we in the legislature haven't really had an ongoing dialogue about what it costs to administer these programs. And for instance, the former foster youth program is a new program. It's a $100,000 scholarship program. There were no administrative dollars associated with that. There's legal fees to establish it, and we're doing that in the face of reductions to our general fund as a result of the special session. So our general fund administrative support is going down, and we do have new programs coming online. And at some point in time, you know, we're at the crash site, in my opinion, about talking about further reductions. So that I just wanted to not to say that these programs, well, enough said. I think I wanted to start out our continuation of our agency presentation and talking about the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, because that is where most of our discussion has been this morning, and I think will be for the balance of this presentation. So I've asked Kathleen Hines, our grants director, if she would start us out on page 109.
Chair Morgan and committee members, my name is Kathleen Hines. I'm the director of the Grants and Scholarships Division at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. As we've already discussed, the Oregon Opportunity Grant is intended to provide low-income Oregon families access and choice in their higher education pursuits. Going to slide 110, the bullets indicate that the Opportunity Grant serves low-income families, students in Oregon's public and private nonprofit colleges. We fund full-time undergraduates. The grant is limited to 12 terms or 8 semesters, and we incorporate federal matching funds. There is one small exception to the 12-term, 8-semester limitation, and then that is for someone who qualifies under the Disability Act. They are permitted to use additional time to complete and get a grant. The next slide regarding expenditures, I think we've talked about quite a bit and we'll probably be revisiting in later discussions. And again, with the grant funding, on slide 1 or page 112, these slides obviously were developed before special session six, and so there has been a 1.2, the balance in the endowment fund is down to $1.2 million, and the federal fund figure, which is recorded on here at $1.4 million, is now zero unless something changes. So that represents a 3.9 reduction from what's on that slide as funding for the program. We have touched a little bit on how the commission is handling the increase in applicants and the reduction in funds available to the program. The slide that represents how many eligible students we are serving, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, indicates that under current application rates and funding levels, the percent of eligibles that we will be able to serve in the 03-04 next academic year is about 49%. Seeing this percent, the commission elected to lower the income eligibility cutoffs for the grant. And so that extra line under there indicates what percent we will be serving, 55%. Do they? 55% of the eligible students, but I want to emphasize.
Do you want to make sure the person here?
Okay. There's a typographical error in that line where it says temporary change to. It's a little tricky to know if that means independent or dependent. Steve?
Mr. Bender?
I just wanted to let you know that it doesn't appear that we've received copies of this slide.
Oh.
So if you do have any available that I can distribute to the committee, I'd be happy to.
We do not. What we will do is we'll correct that slide and then get copies to the committee. I apologize.
The point that I want to make in this is that any subsequent statistics that are represented will show that we are serving 55% of eligible students next year, but that's 55% of a smaller pool of applicants, because the income eligibility has been reduced from 75% of median family income to 55%. So it's a smaller pool that we will be serving a percent of. Okay. I'm going to continue the discussion with giving you a few more statistics, some of which you may have heard, and maybe a review. The number of resident undergraduate applicants has gone from 75,000 to 98,000 in the last 6 years. That's an indication of how many how many applicants, how many more students are attending, and how many more are applying for the program. Out of that, 50,000 students have met the income eligibility and family size. And of that number, 34,500 met the cutoff dates and were able to be awarded. These are statistics that are not on the slides. I'm just painting a picture for you. And out of that, 20,000 recipients. Given the growth in costs and eligible applicants, the elements that we determining which schools are eligible to participate in the program, determining size of awards, income eligibility thresholds, cutoff dates, and enrollment status. Currently, only full-time students are eligible to receive the opportunity grant. Under the statute, part-time students are eligible, but because of funding limitations, it's been a policy decision to fund only full-time students. There are a number of elements impacting this program. The college costs of college are rising. The available funds are decreasing. The median family income hasn't slowed quite as much as we anticipate it will in the next year. We use an average of the last 3 years in determining median family income. That's from the federal government. As we all know, that the recession has not quite caught up, so the figures that we use for median family income still reflect some of the higher earning years in 1999, 2000. And so when median family income starts to drop, there will be more families eligible. In other words, we anticipate that the eligible applicant pool will continue to increase at a fairly high rate. In response to this environment, as I mentioned earlier, the commission elected to lower on slide or page 117 to decrease the income eligibility criteria for families for dependents to 55% of median family income. That is a change of about a 20-year history of funding families that are at the 75% of median family income level. The commission elected to set awards at 11%, and we'll have a discussion later with the budget note that and it's the goal of the coalition to meet 15% of the cost of education, but given the limitation in funding, the commission elected to limit the awards to 11%, which is the level they've been at for several years now. The advisory committee to the commission on the opportunity grant and the commission were intent on trying to keep the cutoff dates no earlier than March 1st. And one of the reasons for this is students that attend state schools and community colleges tend to apply a little later, and we wanted to include as many of those as we could. The way it's shaping up, community colleges will have a cutoff date later than March 1st, and that's been one of our goals because community college students tend to apply later in the year. I wanted to, on slide 118, that's a little bit further discussion of what I've just addressed, that by maintaining the awards at 11% of the cost of education, the goal of the commission was to prevent further erosion of the value of the award. And setting the cutoff dates at 55% of median family income does reduce the pool of eligible applicants. And we have preliminary projections there of how the pool will shrink. I wanted to just some of the next slides, I just wanted to skip up to 126. And it mentions the budget note on the impact of financial aid, and I believe Mr. Clem is going to address that in some of his remarks. And then the commission was asked to produce a budget note regarding the nursing services program. And I can discuss that a little bit now, although what I'd like to do is come back to that and just continue on a couple of the more slides that address the opportunity grant program.
Please continue.
Okay. If we move to slide 129, it's a history of the funding history for the opportunity grant program, and that gives you a a picture of what kind of dollars have gone into this program and how they've increased over the years. And that, you've heard earlier today, there's been discussion of that the general fund is about at the 1999-01 level. I will mention, too, that these slides were, again, created before the special Section 6. So they do represent about $1.4 million in federal funds and an amount of lottery funds that is no longer available. It has 3.7 available lottery funds, and we're anticipating that will be about $1.2 million. And the next slide, 130, is again a pictorial of some of the statistics that we've been discussing about the number of applicants and what funding has been available to fund these applicants. The darker box are those applicants who meet the income guidelines but were too late. They were past the cutoff date to be awarded. And then the white line are those that we have had an opportunity to award. And, of course, the combination of numbers are those that are eligible and met the income family.
Madam Chair.
Senator Leslie.
Could you explain a little further on those that did not receive the awards? I heard you say that they were late in applying. What other factors are included in that bracket? And could you kind of break that out for us?
I can, yes. We have, I'll start at the top. We have an applicant pool, everyone who files a free application for federal student aid. And then we have a pool who are the resident undergraduate applicants. That means they are Oregon residents. They identify an Oregon school. And the next level down are those that are eligible who meet the income and family size. Well, it's a combination of income and family size to determine whether they meet the income criteria. All of those we consider eligible applicants. They identify an Oregon school. They're Oregon residents. They are low income. And then the determining factor at that point on whether or not they get funding is whether they have filed their FAFSA on a date before the cutoff dates. And those cutoff dates are set to control so that an equal number of students or percent of students is served across all segments. This is part of a discussion we had earlier. And so generally the cutoff dates are earlier for private schools, and then they move out a little bit for OUS schools and community colleges, where students who are applying to community colleges, we're able to award them if they apply into April or May, depending on the level of funding. Then beyond that, so we will award any eligible student who meets the income criteria and who has filed their FAFSA before the cutoff date. And then there are a number of and then a certain number of those students pick up and actually enroll and pick up, and they're called recipients. Does that answer your question?
I think so, but so there are other factors in this black box at the top other than just being late to file or did not file in time and those kind of things?
There's Senator Chair Gordon Morgan and Senator Meserle. There are no other factors that would prevent them from receiving an award other than filling out their FAFSA beyond the cutoff date. There are factors that put them in the pool, Oregon resident, and does that answer your question?
Yeah. And why are they not filing on time? Do they decide not to file, or do they change, or they're just not paying attention, or what's going on?
Chair Morgan and Senator Meserle, there's a number of reasons that students don't file before the cutoff dates. I have a number of friends with children, mine included, who procrastinate. Sometimes current college students are later than the new high school seniors tend to file earlier because they're getting all of that financial aid information as seniors. Once they get into college and often have responsibility to file it themselves, they don't. And also students sometimes don't make a decision to continue their education until perhaps spring or summer. Maybe they get a job. Maybe they realize they can't afford it and didn't think they could. There's lots of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize if you've covered that earlier.
No, you're doing good.
Madam Chair, if I might just add one line, because we get asked this question a lot by members of, I go and speak to groups about the opportunity grant, the city club, the community college association, try and build some awareness about it. And they don't understand this cutoff date concept. Why do you do that? And the bottom line is that's the day we run out of money when you consider the other factors. And so I generally don't even use that word. That's the word I use. I say, that's the day we run out of money.
Yeah.
And if you're not in line, if you're still in line when we run out of money, you don't get it. And we control it by a few other factors, but that's the bottom line.
Representative March.
This actually, though, you have some students who wind up leaving in mid-year. So they're, you would, when you granted their grant, you assumed they were going to take through the year. So what do you, how about those half-year grants that you have left? Is there any opportunity to pick up some people in the midstream?
Madam Chair, we over-award knowing that happens. And so we know people aren't going to pick it up at all, even though they were eligible and they got in before it ran out of money, according to cutoff days. So we over-award. And it's not easy to predict. And sometimes, and we've been in front of E-Board before and said, we over-awarded here. And it's been a number of years since we've had that kind of error, but we factor that in to try and hit it exactly right, and it's not easy.
Further questions, comments?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just the reason to, I kind of appreciate you calling it Special Session 6, which many of us have been calling it. My understanding in the add-back list, and I may be wrong with this, I just wanted for clarification, is that while the stability fund was utilized, many of us think appropriately for that, and it did affect your programs, obviously, but that the add back actually put more back into that for the 01-03 biennium than you would have had normally, an extra 100,000. I think the number was 290,000. I don't know if it was a clerical error or what, but you were planning 190,000 to finish the year, and we actually gave you 290,000. And your expectation for 03-05 is based on whatever. But the comment I think you made was you were expecting less in 03-05 than you received in 01-03. And I think that's a reasonable expectation. But what I'm getting to here is, having said all that, even though you were held fairly harmless in the very last part of Special Session 6, not the other sessions, have you developed a budget based on real expectations for 03-05?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, and members of the committee, yes, we have. And the money that was included in the Special Session 6 for the Oregon Opportunity Grant was to account for a governor's reduction in December of that wasn't factored into our calculation, and then also a loss of some interest earnings with the transfer out of the Stability Fund. So we were looking at taking into account two reductions after the fifth special session, after we had already communicated to schools how much they were going to reduce their opportunity grant recipients going forward. So if we had not received that money, we would have had to go back out to the schools again and to tell them you have to return $20, $30 per student. And then there's just a tremendous administrative workload associated with backing out even a dollar out of a student's account. But we have planned for the dollars that we currently anticipate receiving, including the loss of the $2.5 million out of the Educational Stability Fund.
Madam Chair, what I'm trying to recall in response to your question is, did we account for losing all the federal funds, too, when we came up with a March 1st cutoff date as the day we run out of money based on the other factors? Because when we made that decision a few months ago, we didn't know we were going to lose all the federal funds. So sorry to ask questions of my own staff right in front of you, but bottom line is I didn't, when I, you know, we are going to be short some more, and I don't know that we try to build in a little bit of a buffer so we can generally control for community college students who apply later. So the question is, did we have enough of a buffer to absorb all the federal fund losses too without having to go back and change it for next year after the fact and retract what we said we were going to do per student? If not, we'll be doing it next two Fridays from now.
Well, Chair Morgan and committee members, I will say it appears we're not going to quite make the March 1st cutoff date that we had hoped for because of the loss of federal funds. So right now the cutoff date for private schools is February 17th in order to retain enough funding to fund an equal equal percent in each of the other segments, state schools and community colleges.
So we have to move the day we run out of money number, and what that does is shift things to freshmen who primarily apply earlier, and it also takes published documents we put out about the day you could apply, and when they apply before that day, we say, actually, that's changed now, and sorry, you're not eligible because we lost these federal dollars due to this other need the state had, and so you were on February 28th, and I know I said March 1st, but, you know, sorry. And I've had to sign letters like that to every recipient saying, I know I said this last year. I've been chair for about a week, and I signed a letter right before Christmas saying, I'm going to take a 30-year grant in January, another third in spring term. Merry Christmas, Brian Quinn. It was not fun.
Madam Chair. We're basically having a conversation here. I would also follow from that discussion, if you move that date back, that it's going to impact community college students probably the most.
We'll control for that, Madam Chair. We'll control for that part.
Mm-hmm. Frank, hold some money back for it.
Yeah.
The real question is, how much are you going to lose in federal funds with your reduction from the state grant? Because the federal funds are based, as my understanding is, for every $2 of state money, you get about a dollar of federal money or something like that. There's a ratio there. Are you going to lose federal funds in the next 2003-2005 budget because of reduction in state funds? And how much will that be?
I think I've memorized this number, Madam Chair. Representative Bates. You might be able to really help us, too. But there it's not a dollar-for-dollar sort of deal. If you take two out, you lose another one. There are just thresholds. At the governor's recommended budget level, we were still going to lose, I think, something in the neighborhood of $600,000 if that were just it and there had not been the loss of the interest earnings. Now we're talking $1.4 million when you combine governor's recommended, which is $2 million below special session 5, and then the interest earnings, we end up losing it all. If you were able to somehow pump back in, either through general fund or, you know, some money laying around somewhere, $1.5 million, we get another $800,000. So it's actually, you have to get $1.5 million or $1 million. I mean, I'm pretty loose with the numbers here, but something in the neighborhood of $1.3 million, $1.5 million, and then you get another $800,000 for being able to do that. But it's kind of an all or nothing deal. You can't just put in $500,000, get another $200,000 with it.
Well, the notes that I have on the side of this graphic that Mr. Bender gave us is that it would take an infusion of $2.3 million of general fund to fully restore the federal funds.
That's to fully restore back to $1.4 million if you just wanted to capture the $800,000 that were really triggered by only the Education Stability Fund, the number would be smaller. If you want it at all, which we would prefer you do, obviously, to get the free money, then we would want to go to the 2.4 level.
Mr. Bender, would you care to comment on this?
I agree with what Mr. Klein is saying, except that I believe the number that you're referring to, where you get that $800,000 or so, we'd actually need $1.75 million, not $1.3 million. But in other words, it's not a dollar-for-dollar thing. You have to put in, if you don't put in an additional $1.75 million, you're not going to get an additional federal dollar. Once you do that, you get about $800,000 roughly, and then as you further increase it, that's when you start getting this one additional dollar for every two additional state dollars, up to, if you were able to find $2.3 million, we could be back at the level that had been in the governor's budget for federal funds.
So it then appears to be an issue of increasing the level of support, or rather not decreasing the level of support, in order to maintain eligibility for the federal funds.
Correct. They have a maintenance of effort requirement, and we're sort of in the unusual situation where if we hadn't increased funding prior by any, we might still be making at this level, you might still be able to get the federal funds, mm-hmm. because every time when you increase your funding, then that raises the bar that the mm-hmm. federal government sets on you in order to maintain, you have to continue to maintain that funding before you get the federal funds. Sort of an ironic situation.
It's a problem that our brains have, where we can't look forward with nearly the exactitude that we can look backwards. Do you have more in your presentation for us?
I don't have anything more in the opportunity grant. I can discuss the other programs, this private scholarship program, nursing services, and rural health, if you like. It's up to you. But nothing more to present on the opportunity grant.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, would you like us to talk about the study that we did on the Oregon Opportunity Grant at this point?
Well, what I'd like to do here, if it's possible, Mr. Andine has requested being able to come forward and to speak on behalf of the independent colleges about the flat grant idea that we've been discussing, and I would appreciate having his input into the discussion. So if you could kind of make room for him up there, that would be fine with me.
You could stay.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gary Andine. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Independent College Association, representing 17 of the regionally accredited nonprofit colleges and universities in the state. I appreciate your giving me a moment here. I want to express complete concurrence with Representative Bates' comments about concern for getting the most bang for our public dollar, and I think everybody in this room this morning is really focused on how we get access for low and moderate income Oregonians to college. But I do need to remind everybody here that 98% or more of your access dollars are not in this budget. There in other budgets you will be hearing in coming weeks, budgets that total more than $1 billion of operating funds to public institutions, the vast bulk of which drives down tuition in those institutions. On average, the tuition reduction is over $5,000 per student in those because of those dollars. And those $5,000 plus subsidies go to every student who goes to a public institution, regardless of his or her need for public assistance. There's a lot of money there that's going out to people who really don't need help to pay for college. While we are not funding nearly enough money for low-income students wherever they choose to go to college. I've said on some other occasions, we would, in the private sector, we would love to see a flat grant if all the access dollars were on the table and just divided equally among all low-income Oregonians who need help going to college. But the vast bulk of the access dollars are not in this budget, and I hope you will remember that as the weeks go by, because you have to plug a $2 billion hole in the state's overall budget, and there are a lot of dollars that are not being spent really helping needy students here. So those are my comments. I might also add that the largest opportunity grant you give to a student at a private college, probably an eligible student who gets in on time, going to Reed, which is the highest priced school in the state, is smaller than the subsidy that goes to every student, regardless of wealth or poverty, at a public institution. And every time you do that, you've saved the public one more space at a public institution by getting that student over into a private sector institution where we do have space for more students. So if you're looking for ways to stretch the public dollars this session as much as you can, I really hope that you would think very hard about making sure as many students can go to a private college who want to, because that's saving you money in the long run. Thank you.
Questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Do you want to cover that?
Mm-hmm.
No, this question?
Oh, do you have information on the issue that was raised before by Representative Smith?
That is exactly what we have. I'll try to do it. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, regarding the commuter costs, these are the arguments now that I see them, that I heard. One, there are no other programs, federal or otherwise, that require this kind of calculation to be removed. And that was the largest burden, was the administrative nightmare to be the first in the nation in a program to try and create and figure out at each campus of how we would do that. The other big problem is the 6 to 9 month jump around period for students who change constantly residence. I think I moved, 4 or 5 times at least, home mm-hmm. and back and home and back. And you would have to basically change their new package. You'd give them a new package of aid, or you have to recalculate every time they moved where now, whether they're at home or whether they were now in Albany and not in Corvallis, and Albany's cheaper. So that was part of it. And then the cost The cost is an average that truly represents a typical student. At community colleges, a student typically is older and single and does have rent and food costs. At OUS, they live on campus. So that's already factored in to their school's cost of education that then we end up basing our formula on. So really what you're describing is already factored in on a campus level. So the tuition level or the aid package at a community college is going to be different already on their calculations because they assume those things. So we just end up getting the benefit of factoring in the living costs in the town the college is located in. This is, I'm sure, convoluted. I'll give you this paper, which has it all written out really nicely.
Representative Smith, you look like you need a follow-up question.
Yeah.
I need a follow-up.
I don't want to belabor this issue today, but if I could study what he's saying and talk with him and maybe talk with you separately and not take committee's time on this today.
That would be very helpful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Masri has a shadow that
you, Madam
we would
Chairman.
Like to be introduced to.
Madam Chairman and colleagues, I have sitting next to me here Zachary Burke from Gilkey Middle School in Portland, and he's going to be my shadow today, and I thought what a great experience for him to see it from this side of the table.
Yes.
Welcome.
Absolutely.
Now, we're back to where, do you have anything else that you wish to present to the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. We would like to, at this point in time, talk with you about our budget note study. And it is in your appendix, and it has a blue cover. It is called College Access and Persistence in Oregon. And there is a fair amount of detailed information in here, but before I do that, Brian, our chair and I haven't rehearsed this, but do you want to start out and provide a summary, or do you want me to?
I'll just give a little bit.
Sure.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith has a shadow, but we'll wait until they do the preliminaries before we introduce him to This is probably a good break.
Yes.
Representative Smith, could you introduce your shadow to us?
Yes. This is a student from Gilkey Middle School, and your name is, sir?
Edmund.
Edmund.
Welcome.
And he is my shadow for 2 days.
Ah.
All right.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I also have a shadow.
See, we can't leave out. See what Senator Medley started.
Sorry.
Thank you, Steve.
It's an arms race.
Oh, is that what it is?
There's two arms.
Senator Mesley, would you move down one?
We can do that.
Let's move down one.
That's a good opportunity.
I think we're preparing these folks, letting them know that they have to apply early for the Student Opportunity Grant.
Yeah.
Excellent idea.
Probably just apply now.
Yeah, apply now. There might not be any money left.
Madam Chair, do you realize what you asked me to do to move all this mess of papers along?
It's probably the most exercise you're going to get today,
That's
Senator.
Right.
Senator Gordley, if you could do the honors.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Seated next to me is Holly Lordson from Gilkey Middle School. She's an eighth grader, and it's just really wonderful to have her with us this morning.
Thank you, and welcome to all the students. This is probably an area of public policy that you will personally have a lot of interest in. We're not doing the K-12 system today, but we're doing a discussion on the scholarships and economic opportunities that are available to students that come into the community college system and the higher ed system. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, I'm just going to give a few seconds on why we did this, and then we'll go into the findings, and I can comment as we go about those. And students, make sure you see our website. We've got lots of private and you know state and federal money on there to help you when you're ready to go to college. So we'll get you our website.
And file early.
And maybe don't trust me when I give you a date, and do a little earlier than that, too.
So this is a warning that you're going to be moving the cutoff dates back even farther?
No. If you want us to, that's what we'll do. Our budget note really came as a request last session. And, you know, to be candid, at first I thought I had all the answers about the program and why did we need to study this. But it really turned out to be an excellent exercise because we hadn't done statistical analysis on what happens to people once they get the grant in school. Do they stay in school longer if they get the grant than if they don't get the grant? And do they make the sacrifice to get the grant and go and then lose it and leave, or keep getting it and stay. Do they, you know, like me, when I was sitting in Coos Bay, if I had not got in early enough, would I have just stayed in Coos Bay? We didn't have a statistical study to say, yeah, there is a percentage change in whether you got it before we ran out of money or you got in after we ran out of money and didn't get it. So we'll present our findings. There's also some other questions in there that are on different topics. I can't quite remember now. But the main focus was what's the effectiveness or what's the effect of the grant on college attendance and persistence once you get there. And these are the kind of findings when I mentioned I've talked to the Community College Association, the Salem City Club, a variety of other groups. This is what I go and tell them about, is that, you know, in my view, this grant really does have an effect, even at it what I think is a, you know, probably slightly underfunded level, but even at this level, it still has some numbers attached with it. So you all owe Senator Schrader, then Representative, a thank you for having asked us for this. We spent a lot of time and effort and designing the questions and tracking it, but we really have some, I think, excellent information for you that helps you feel good about the program and be able to buy into it, because we now know exactly what happens in certain categories that we were asked to find out about, at least.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and shadows, I am in the report itself, and I would just like to bring your attention to a couple of pages. And the first one is Roman numeral V11, Roman numeral 7, and that's the executive summary, and it details in bold the four areas that we were asked to research. The first one was to identify the level of financial aid that is sufficient to affect access and persistence. The second question was, or requirement was, to recommend a level of financial aid that could make a difference. The third was identify the impact of the opportunity grant on college participation of lower income Oregonians. And the fourth one was to make a recommendation about a merit-based aid program in Oregon. And I'd just like to pause a moment and just say that there is a tremendous amount of work and intellect that went into this study and this report. And I would like to publicly thank and acknowledge the good work that Karen Crane, who is this woman two rows back, who spent evenings, weekends, and a tremendous amount of energy in preparing this report, and also Jeff Mays, who did some statistical analysis for us. And I would be remiss if I didn't say thank you to the colleges and universities who shared their information with us that allowed us to be able to pull this information together and prepare this report. So this is a fine piece of work, and I just want to recognize all the minds that went into it, along with other staff and the commission, in preparing this report for you. I would like to go to page 6 of this report and just talk about why education beyond high school is important. And I had distributed a sheet to you folks prior to our budget hearing that talks about the public and private benefits of higher education. There are social and economic benefits, and it just isn't getting a college education and getting a better paying job. We have citizens who pay taxes. We have citizens who use less of our state resources, health care. Higher the education you have, the less likely you're going to be in jail. So those are public and private benefits of a post-secondary education. I would now like to take your attention to page 10, and there is a chart on there that talks about access to college. And this is the chart that troubles me the most, because when you break apart students who are going to if you break apart families into income quartiles, you'll find nationally and in Oregon as well, is that the more money your family makes, the more likely you're going to go to school. And based upon this chart, 86%, or my math is correct, 6 out of 7 high-income families, their children are going to go to school. On the other hand, if you are from the lowest quartile, 1 out of every 2 is going to go to school. So that, to me, is why we have an Oregon Opportunity Grant in Oregon. I would now like to go to page 13, and this is just some sense of what has happened historically. Back in the early 90s, the percentage of aid that came from grants and the percentage of aid that came from loans was about equal. And about 93, 94, all of a sudden you saw a reversal of the balance in those two types of resources, and then it has just gotten wider and wider. And we call that the grant loan imbalance.
Senator Mesley.
If I might go back to the graph showing the different income levels and the likelihood of going to school.
On page 10?
Yes. I'm really curious whether you see that pattern in all economies, and I'm trying to compare the metro economy compared to economy in my Senate district where it's, the average income is about half. And at least historically has been about half. Do you see the same number of swings? Or, and I'm wondering whether people in a really down economy that has been consistently down for a long time recognize the need to get an education to get out of this situation, or are they just at the bottom and can't, you know, they can't fathom or can't vision how to get out?
Madam Chair, Senator Mesley and members of the committee, we were not able to go to that fine of a degree, but my sense is that you are correct, that if we were to go into some of the rural communities, we're going to find a higher level of lower-income Oregonians residing in those areas. And so most of them are going to be in that 57% quartile, one out of every two. There's also a psychological impact of rising cost of education that influences people's decision to go to school. And as the costs rise, if you have somebody who has an income of $15,000 and they're thinking about going to Lane Community College, which has a cost of education, including tuition, rent, of over $11,000, psychologically, I think that blows some people's minds.
If I could follow up, Madam Chair. And part of where I'm coming from is that I've seen the statistics and the figures that show that some of our rural community colleges, the communities support their community college at a higher rate than they do in the metro areas. And to me, that indicates that they recognize that that is a very important factor of their community. And I'm just wondering, my question, I guess, is, does that follow through with the students? Do they see a higher percentage of the low quartile students that are seeking to get an education?
Madam Chair, I'd probably take a stab at that since I grew up there. Yeah, I know exactly, you know, what you're getting at. I think in town, you know, in Coos Bay, there were the folks who were in the higher income quartiles, either because they, you know, their parents were doctors or lawyers or had a good longshore job or whatever. There are some cultural factors about whether your parents went to college and, you know, whether you think you can still make it down there without going out and getting another job or getting some education then maybe coming back. The fact is that most of those income quartiles, when we talk lower income, that's a larger percentage of the population in Coos Bay, obviously. But I do think that there are differences that match this number. So my friends whose parents had a lot of money, they pretty much knew they were going to college, and they never even questioned it. I didn't know I was going to college until I got my aid statement. So when I got the grant, then I moved from the lower income quartile calculation into, okay, I can do what my friend, you know, Greg Steele's doing, whose dad's the eye doctor in town, and he was going to college for sure. And that was kind of the pattern in my life that certainly matched this. I think you will find, though, if you and Senator Gordley both went to each other's districts for a day, the challenges are almost the same in lower economic parts of Oregon, and it crosses, you know, ethnic lines and everything else. It's, you know, we've got our farm in Hood River, and it's now starting to turn into a place where these people who used to have some decent incomes are becoming opportunity grant eligible because our farms aren't making any money at all. So now they're starting to eyeball these state programs that they used to think, why did I pay for this, and think, how can I apply for this? And it's happening. And, you know, it's definitely a different economy in different places. But these patterns hold with the slight difference that in cultural situations where you think you can do okay without going to college through some other means or used to be able to 20 years ago. Some people, for some reason, don't see the need to go to college, even though the finances, you might make the finances available and they still don't think they need to go. Why is beyond me, but my brother was able to go to college, take my stepbrother, get a job in a Portland company that then got bought out by a global company, move back to Coos Bay. He makes a good Portland income and lives in Coos Bay and is able to do it from there by having went in the military, got the education help, and went back. So there are people who want to do it, we help when we provide aid.
Thank you. Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, this information may be in this, but I'm not quickly finding it. That lower quartile, do you have any figures to show how many of those actually go, not just enter higher education, but graduate in comparison to the other quartiles? I would assume it's the completion rate is also significantly lower, too. And it may be in here. I've just missed it. But.
I think, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I think I'll let our staff comment on that. But they're definitely, because all of our people in our pool are low income, when we do talk about persistence when they get the grant and when they don't get the grant and they end up not making it all the way through, you're going to see some of those numbers.
Thanks.
So, and you may have more specifics.
Madam Chair, if I might invite Karen Crane, who is, understands this before inside and out, I'm sure that she can answer that more quicker than I can.
Walk into the place.
All right.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Karen Crane, coordinator of state financial aid projects at the Student Assistance Commission. Yes, Representative Bates, that does hold true for graduation rates. We do have a chart. I was just flipping through here trying to find it. It's a large report. But we definitely looked at graduation rates by income, and it definitely holds true. Higher-income students graduate at a much higher rate than low-income students do.
Is that the chart on page 18, by any chance?
Let's see. It's here. I remember looking at it. That's the...
It may be on page 41.
That's a good one. Yes, that is a very good one. That's National Statistics. NCES, which is the National Center for Educational Statistics, produced this. And it is one of many, many charts out there in the educational statistic world that shows that there is always a direct relationship between income and educational attainment. And that's why the Opportunity Grant is so valuable, because it is the program in Oregon that helps these low-income students get some attempt at parity with the higher income levels. Yes, page 41 is where we actually looked at the Oregon statistics, the sample that we looked at in Oregon, which was a sample of 2,000 students across all educational sectors in Oregon. And in the lowest income quartile, you can see the graduation rate of all the students in the study was 16.9%. Graduation rate of the highest income students was 35.8%. So over a doubling of the rate. And what we haven't gotten into yet is that the Opportunity Grant affects these numbers. Students who receive the grant attend school and graduate at higher rates than equally low-income students that did not receive the grant. I assume Jeff is going there.
The next page that I'd like to take you to is page 14, and we will get to that here shortly. But these two graphs or charts here talk about the pipeline to college, and in essence, these are really the gates that a student needs to go through in order to enroll in college. If they don't have the aspiration, you know, it stops right there. But if they have the aspiration, they haven't prepared academically, they're not going to be able to. They may be able to go to college, but not the college of their choice. And one of the most telling tales is whether they take the college entrance exams, the SAT or the ACT. And then the next box talks about the risk factors that have been shown to affect college aspiration. And guess what? Number one on the chart is student family incomes in the lowest quartile. I want to move on to page 16, which talks about persistence in college. And this is generally research shows that if you are full-time, attend a public or independent four-year institution, lived on campus, receive financial aid, and work less than 15 hours per week, the likelihood that you're going to have the highest persistence rate is good. On the other hand, the bullets down below talk about the seven non-traditional characteristics among college students, and guess what? They're not matching up with those characteristics that are associated with a high persistence rate. And what's interesting in that study is that they found that 27% of American students fit this profile of being full-time students working less than 15 hours, and that 73% meet the non-traditional characteristics. And we see that in especially in our community colleges. I think if you talk to a community college, their average age is 27, 35, 37. So a large number of non-traditional students. I want to go to page 26, and that is earlier at the very beginning, I gave you a handout of a sample financial aid package for 2000-2001, and the numbers that are on this page in the report is the first set of columns, and now with the increased cost of education, that typical unmet need on this sample is now 3,800 instead of 2,800. And moving on, I want to go to page 35, which does talk about access to college in Oregon. And based upon income quartile, that the access is higher for upper income families than compared to low income families. And then if we go to the next page, that is where Ms. Crane was indicating that the opportunity grant does make a difference. And 57.3% enroll who receive the opportunity grant versus 45.6 who qualified but as we alluded to earlier, didn't make the cutoff date. I want to,
Madam Chair, just to reiterate that number again. That is one of the key findings right there. That and it doesn't work out to be 27.5% increase.
27%.
You get your application on time, you get the money, you get in a day late. 27.5% greater increase that next fall if you got it in a day early. For as low as something in the neighborhood of $1,060 at a community college. So the number goes up from 45 to 57, but that's almost a 28% increase in attendance that next fall just for getting our one little grant. That assumes you're working, you got your federal work study, you got your Pell Grant, you got some scholarships. Our one grant was the variable we could control for there.
I want to direct your attention to page 39, and this is the answer to the question, what amount of aid could make a difference, to the start of that of our answer. And in looking at the sample of population, for the lowest income quartile in this sample, the average unmet need is about $4,000. For the upper income quartile, there was no unmet need. And in our recommendations that will follow shortly, we are proposing a stair-step solution to that. And I say that with some hesitation because of our budget situation. And then the next area is talking about the persistence to degree in Oregon, and that gets back to Representative Bates' question. And this is the slide, the page where we talked about that. It does increase persistence to graduation. And I want to close by going to page 45 and briefly review the recommendations as a result of this report. And I'm not going to read them, but I do want to just point out that the number two recommendation was to increase funding in the Oregon Opportunity Grant to 15% of the average cost of attendance and to standardize income eligibility categories between independent and dependent. And I just briefly want to talk about that. We talked about 75% of median family income for dependent students, and we use a 50% median family income for independent students. I struggle with that because if you have a single mother with three children who is trying to go to school, we're going to use 50% of that family's median family income to determine whether or not she gets an opportunity grant. But if she has a child who is also going to school, under our old criteria, we would use 75% of median family income. So the commission's sense is let's equalize the income threshold. And our goal was to move up to the 75% median family income for all students. And instead, because of the current budget situation we find ourselves in, we've gone down to 55% for dependent students. So we're going in the wrong direction. And then number four was once we had achieved those goals, to move the amount of the award to up to 20% of the cost of education. And that 20% of cost of education would, in essence, put the lowest income quartile student on the same footing as the family in the third, second to the highest income quartile.
Before we leave this section, let me ask you a question. Going back over the discussions that took place at the commission when you were deliberating this study and deciding where to go on it, if you were, in your opinion, to go back now knowing what the state of the economy is and the state of the resources that you're going to have available to you, do you think that you would have drawn the same recommendations?
Madam Chair, do you mean for the next, 1 year on a short-term basis or where we want the program to go in the long term?
I would say looking out over maybe the next couple of biennium.
I think we would have still said that our goal needs to be, in fact, 15% is, I think, in my view, low, because I set my criteria based on where the low-income quartile meets, I think, the third-income quartile. So the poor kid looks at a financial aid statement, sees that they've got the same unmet need once the state was done helping them that the kid three quartiles above. That's where I come into this. 21% is about that number, but I thought you would throw me out of here if I said that. So we would still stay at 11%. We wouldn't go lower as a commission. I can guarantee that because we had a recommendation that we rejected unanimously. For our advisory committee gave us a lower percentage number, and we rejected that because we feel that the grant size makes a difference. If we were to throw it among every eligible applicant, we'd have a $300 grant, and that was like the local car dealer scholarship I got. It meant it was great, but it didn't push me into school at all. And so I would give the same recommendation for the long term that we need to not go down. We need to go back because it's wasting money. It's wasting human capital. It's wasting resources. It's leaving, in my business, apples on the tree. I could take the market for a little bit more expenditure. I think in this biennium, what we're asking is what we're obligated to ask, which is the governor's recommended budget. That's what I have to tell you I think is the right number because I'm appointed by the governor. In the long term, I don't think the governor wants to be at down $2 million and also losing some lottery funds also. But I think we would give you the same recommendation and for the short term because what we did was, and this was not easy, we changed a 20-year formula to take people out of the pool by income rather than by running out of money earlier. But I thought that was the most humane, rational, logical way to say maybe these other folks have a little bit more discretionary money. I know, none of them have really excess dollars because when we look at their financial aid statement, they still have unmet need after parental contribution, all that stuff's factored in. But, you know, we talked to a lot of people, former chairs of the Ways and Means Committee, the Oregon Center for, I think it's called Public Policy out of Silverton, about the working poor, and they said it makes a big difference. You know, a $10,000 to $12,000 income range, you could maybe get some more elasticity in your budget to shield a blow like this. So I think we would come to the same conclusions, because it was only 2 months ago, and we knew most of this at that time, and spent, I don't know how many hours, 3 hours in a meeting and 15 hours talking to people before the meeting to try and come up with the package that we were going to use to implement these. And we didn't want to do it in a way that hurt people but made a great political message that there's a big problem. We tried to do it in a rational way. We shielded the numbers. You know, now we have 55% unserved versus 49. There were people who thought we should still have 55 and not change our formula, because that would show you there's really a problem. We've changed the formula to cover the problem a little bit, but we tried to do that for a good policy reason.
Thank you.
I don't know whether I short-circuited you off the end of your presentation or not.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, no, you did not. I think that in closing, I would just like to go back and reflect on some of the public testimony that we received in support of the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. And if there's one piece of testimony that I could isolate on, it would be the woman who spoke about being on public assistance and being on the Oregon Health Plan and being on food stamps, and that her plan and goal is to find herself in a position where she has a family wage job to where she is contributing to the economy instead of being a consumer of state goods and services. And I think that's the place that I would like to leave this, is that I really believe that by providing access to education to all Oregonians strategically and holistically, we end up coming out on the positive side of the balance sheet with an investment in the Oregon Opportunity Grant. That's my plug. So.
Committee members, any parting comments, final questions, sage advice? We'll take anything at this point. Well, seeing nothing then further in the hearing on this bill, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5052. I don't think that we actually have any more housekeeping issues to bring before us. I would bring to your attention the agenda for next week that we had in our places. And if there is no further business before this committee, I will adjourn this meeting and we'll reconvene at 8:30 a.m. on Monday morning.